This is the Living Clean Podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back to the Living Clean Podcast. I'm Mason S. I'm an addict. I'm back for another episode. This week we're going to do things a little different. I'm going to give a shout out to Donald B. I made kind of a appreciation post on the Facebook page. Donald B. commented and said that he really has enjoyed the Living Clean study and some of the history stuff that we're doing, but he really misses the personal stories. And Francis and I just happened to need an episode for this week. So we thought, in the spirit of giving the listeners what they want, we'll bring back the personal stories. We recently had our guest tonight on the podcast during a Living Clean study. And Francis has kind of put the bug in my ear ever since then that this guy had a really amazing story, and if we ever got the chance, we'd bring him back on, and that's what we're doing tonight. Before I get too far in my ramble, I'm going to introduce both of our, my co-host and our guest tonight. We'll start with Francis.
My name's Francis. I'm an addict, and my clean date is December 22nd, 1992. Today, I'm 1 month shy of 32 years.
Ooh.
And yeah, my home group is Willows Basic Recovery Group in Willows, California. Come on down. It's Thursday night. Lots of clean time there. I was excited to have my buddy Kevin on.
Yeah. So without further ado, we're going to introduce Kevin.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kevin. I'm an addict. My clean date is 12/25/2013. And I'm just really excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me back.
Yeah, welcome back, man. I'm looking forward to this. One thing I want to say before we get started, Francis and I just got back from the Colorado Regional Convention. What a great job that committee did putting together an event, the hotels and everything in Denver. I mean, the meetings outside of Denver, everything was great. And I'm speaking for me, I had one of the best experiences of my recovery there. And Francis, you want to kind of touch on that just for a second? What was your thoughts about Colorado?
Well, went to a great history presentation by Ron H. from Albuquerque, and got to hang out with Chris and Boyd, you know, like the NA history dudes. And it was just amazing. I'm in the middle, like, nickeling and diming the movie Ford versus Ferrari because of the experience of going and seeing the Shelby Museum. I guess we got to see kind of some personal side of Chris and Boyd, and Boyd P apparently is a motorhead, and every opportunity he gets, he goes and explores like museums for classic automobiles. And so we went and checked out the Shelby Museum in Denver. Actually, I think it was in Boulder, but it was kind of cool to cut loose of the convention and hang out with those guys and learn a little bit more about NA history. And Chris, making us listen to old AA history symposium stuff and trying to teach us a lesson that AA history is NA history. So that was interesting. Good times.
Yeah, it was a great time. Shout out to that Shelby Museum. If you're a car person, you need to check that out. It is incredible. Unbelievable. But anyways, not to take up any more Kevin's time. So like I said, Francis had put this bug in my ear after we had Kevin on the Living Clean study. So, you know, I guess, Kevin, the first thing I would ask you is kind of where everybody starts is, you know, we don't have to go through the entire thing, but if you would like, kind of take us up from when you first got introduced to using and up until you get ready to give NA a shot.
Hi, everybody. My name's Kevin. I'm an addict. And again, I just want to say thanks for inviting me back here, Mason. And it's an honor to be here with you. And of course, Francis, one of my mentors and just someone I admire in general. So to have him advocate for me is an honor, you know? I hear people talk about sometimes like remembering that first time they pick up. And I don't remember the first time I picked up. I remember wanting to change the way I feel from a very early age. I remember going through the spice cabinet at my mom's and trying to smoke everything in there to change the way I feel, and scraping banana peels and stealing cigarettes. And, I'm 53, so everyone had liquor cabinets back in the 70s. Eventually, we graduated to going through those and found definite way to change the way we feel. And at some point, I figured out how to get a hold of some weed. And by the time I was 12, 13 years old, I was selling weed at the high school to pay for my habit, I grew up here in Northern California. I got in a little bit of trouble and moved down to Southern California. And I guess looking back, I never really thought about that before now. That was kind of like first attempt to getting clean, really, with no recovery. I went down there and sort of changed some of my behavior, but not really my attitude, and eventually I got into some trouble there and ended up coming back up here to Red Bluff, California, where I'm from, and just started going again. By the time I got out of high school, I was an active addict, and I hit the road. Started doing Grateful Dead shows about that time too, and met some girl and followed her up to Eugene, me and my buddy, and lived up there. And from there I went on the road full time because, I couldn't maintain a house and it was just the thing to do, and so there were some good things about the hippie lifestyle, if you will, that I was able to sort out in my fourth step, some values of kindness, and my violent upbringing didn't fit in well in that world, and I had to learn to pivot on that. But it really normalized the drug culture for me, just submersing myself in that drug culture. It was a place where everyone was not just getting loaded, but glamorizing it, and so that was the thing to do. And eventually, on that journey of exploration, if you will, I found opiates, and the kind hippie lifestyle soon changed. That became a very much consuming aspect of my life, and stuff went downhill quickly. Around that time, I had met a female who became my hostage off a dead tour, who also became strung out with me, and we had a young child. And when you're that deep in that kind of addiction, like, you kind of intuitively know it's a dead end road, and that you got to get off that wheel, if you will. And we tried to get off the wheel a couple times up there and could never stay clean. I probably got kicked out of every detox in Portland at some point, and eventually, like, everything, I could just couldn't hold it together anymore. And we moved back down here to Northern California and moved in with my mom. Did I get clean? I quit using opiates, for the most part, and we sort of put together a life. And really, that seems to be like for the next, that was 97, and I didn't get clean till 2013. So for the next 15 years, it seemed like I just would go through that cycle of kind of trying to do good, but then messing things up and always fixing yesterday's problems. We get a place and we'd get a car and kind of get things going in the right way. And then, like, I would get in trouble, get on probation. So I got to jump through the hoops to do that. Or I would lose the jobs, like all these things because the unmanageability of my addiction. I would end up like destroying whatever good that I built up, and for me, like it was never the addiction. It was the old lady. It was the boss. It was the cops. If everyone would just leave me alone, everything would be fine, right? And I would work real hard to protect that addiction, I realized, and what a gift it is to finally get clean and be able to surrender and quit that fight, So anyway, yeah, the next 15 years, like we're like that. We even bought a house at some point, and then I lost all that too. Me and the kid's mom had split up, and when we split up, I just went hard. I'd kind of been the one holding it together. She had switched from heroin to alcohol, and even though I was doing pills and weed, like I couldn't tolerate the alcohol, and so we split up. And when she split up, I just kind of went hog wild with it and started in with the opiates again, and things quickly deteriorated. So in 2000, I want to say eight-ish, 2006, 2008, after we'd split up, she'd gotten help. She had started going to the other fellowship, right, for the problems, because she fell apart too, and she was actually, God bless her soul, my first taste of recovery. I remember her coming over one day, and we're arguing or something, and I'm trying to manipulate her like I always did, and she is like not reacting and setting healthy boundaries. And you know what I mean? Like this is a different person I'm dealing with. And I finally stopped and I said, "Who are you?" And she got kind of defensive for a second, and I said, "It's good, And what I seen before me was the person that I'd always seen inside of her manifesting itself, And she told me about what she'd been doing, And at that point, I was ready to try and get clean. So I started. I followed her into the other fellowship, and I think about after the third or fourth time, I told them that alcohol was for people who can't handle heroin. It was strongly suggested to me to try the other fellowship, and I ended up in Narcotics Anonymous, and that was, like I said, about 2008. And I would, I didn't get far enough to understand playgrounds, playmates, and playthings. And I tried to hold on to some of that stuff, again, trying to control my using to some degree. And I would get, 2, 3, 4 weeks clean and then relapse, and it was kind of I was one of those dudes who, and I never lied about it. I had my hand up constantly, for the white tag, and I did that for a couple of years, and I think it took me about 2 years to put together 6 months clean, and at about 6 months clean, I went back out and didn't come back, and I caught my first prison term in 2010. I was, let me see, almost 40 years old, little old for the prison game, and I went into prison, and of course, wasn't completely clean in there, but I tried to stay clean. And when I got out, with the best of intentions, like so many of us do in these situations, to do the right thing, and to, I was gonna go stay with my 95-year-old grandmother and take care of her. And I got out, and remember, I got this job that I had to cross town, and the hall had moved. Right. And so I was working swing shift, and I had to drive right by where they all hanging out smoking before the meeting. And I was working like a night shift where I'm going as they're like sitting out there going into the meeting, and people would wave and tell me to come on. And, eventually I found myself driving around the block before I'd cross them to not have to see them every day. And after about 2 months of being out, I thought I deserved a break and picked up again. And I tell you what, Mason, those next 4 months, even though it was the shortest run of my life, it was the longest run of my life. And everything just kind of picked right back up where I started. And within a month, I'm barely making it back to grandma's, and I'm living in Motel 6 and just doing all the things I do to support my addiction, right? And cheating on parole. And I'm actually on my way to parole one day. And I tell you what, the day before, because I just knew that I was back, back on that dead end. I'd called again my kid's mom, and said, I need help. And she called around a couple places, and she found a detox that I could get into that day, and they called me. And of course, that day was a little too soon. They called me and said, we got a bed, come on up. And I said, whoa, hold on. I gotta take care of some business first. Like, I'm running some Fortune 500 company, right? I just need to get loaded one more day. And my plan was to wrap up my business and go in the next day. And the next morning, on the way to parole, I get pulled over by the task force in my hometown, and they know what I'm doing, and they know where I'm at, and they know about the hotel, and they drag me back over to the motel, and I meet my new parole officer handcuffed on the balcony of this Motel 6 while they're turning over my room, and I look at him, I'm like, hey man, I need help, and he just laughs at me like, no shit, you need help. Why don't you deal with this first, and then we'll talk. And I think he thought that they were gonna hold me. And I thought they were gonna hold me too. And they took me to jail. And I tell you what, I was relieved. I say that just because that's part of the insanity, to actually be relieved to get arrested, because I knew that it was the only way that I could stop is when I'd get arrested, And I'm sitting in there, that the what do they call it, the booking, for 10 hours, and I'm starting to get sick, right? I'm ready for a bed, and I'd been in that jail before, and I know the sergeant, and I hit her up, and I'm like, hey Sarge, let me sign the release of property. And she's like, what are you talking about? And I said, well, I'm gonna be out for a couple days, and I don't want you guys bugging me. And basically, like, I knew the drill, like, sign the release of property. Let the ex-wife, who I'm not even together with, who's been raising my kids for the last 3 years while I'm in prison, come deal with my shit once again, Let her come get my keys and my bank card and deal with all that kind of stuff, That's just what my where my expectations were at that point. But when I asked to sign that paperwork, she's like, Kevin, we're releasing you. You're getting OR'd. And I was like, what? And she could tell that I was scared. And she pulled me aside a few minutes later and said, hey, if you need a bed, I'll hold you. But of course, as soon as I heard I was getting out, the gears in my head were turning again. I'm like, yes, I'm back in the game. And they let me out, and I'm like, I'm back in the game. And that hit me like, oh God, I'm back in the game. Like, that's kind of horrible, Here I was relieved a couple hours ago to get arrested, And I did something new. I showed up at the parole the next morning. He was just as surprised as I was that I got out. I think he didn't put a hold on me because he thought they were gonna hold me. And I told him I needed a program. And he makes a call, and he comes back a few minutes later. He's like, you're lucky. This place up in Redding's got one bed open for someone who didn't show up yesterday. And it was the same bed that my wife had gotten for me that I didn't go to. And now I have it for, 90 days paid for by parole, And of course, looking back, this is the first instance where I can acknowledge something greater in my life working for me, a higher power working my life before I believed in a higher power. And I get up there, and I feel like this is a long version of this story, but this is my getting clean moment, and it's important to me. So I'm sharing it with you guys. I get up there, and I'm in that detox, and I'm sick as a dog. And they end up leaving me in there for 5 days in a 3 day detox. And about the fifth or sixth day, I can barely make it down the stairs to go to the regular program, and I think my second day hitting the floor, this dude who I'd met in prison seen me in there, and he's like, "Oh, come back to my room after dinner." And I get up there, and he's got some dope, and he's getting loaded in this place, you know. And even though like I had wanted, I have I'd gotten busted again on parole. I'm still on parole. I got a new case. I want nothing more in the world to be clean. But as soon as the drugs are in front of me, I can't not do them, even when I don't want to. And I get loaded with this dude, and I instantly tell him it's not good enough. It's not enough. Get me a phone, right? And he gets me a phone, and next thing you know, I got drugs being delivered to this rehab, you know, and I proceed to get everyone in the house pretty much loaded. I got my roommate there selling drugs to the other people and bringing it in. And one of the guys there, you know, who wants to be clean, another dude who was in prison with us, calls a meeting of the fellas, you know, and is like, "We see you guys walking around here getting loaded, and you know, like some of us are serious. If you don't want to be here, leave." And they're like trying to like threaten us and push up on us. And again, here's my insanity is like I stand up and be like, "I'm the one who got the drugs in here. I'm loaded, but I need to be here and I'll fight any one of you for my bed." Right? Like, I want to be clean, but I'm getting loaded in this house, but I'm willing to fight to be there. It makes no sense to me now, you know? And they quieted up a little bit and they did what any good convict would do. They went and they told. And so the next day we all get called into this room by a member of our fellowship who also worked there at the time. And she's this I'm trying to see a nice way to say that. She's a big girl, and she's an old gangster, Southsider, and she is with the business, and she is mad as hell. And she calls us all in that room, and she's like, "I'm testing all you MFs." And I did another new thing, Mason, is I t when she called me over there, I told her the truth. And I said, "Look, you know, I'm the one who brought the stuff in the house. I'm loaded. I really want to be here. Can you help me?" And she's like, "You're the only one who's gotten honest with me." She's like, "I can't promise you anything, but I'll see what I can do." And she basically sat me in the corner. She's like, "Go sit over there. Don't talk to anyone. And I'll see what I can do." And so I'm over there sitting in the corner like a punished child that I am. And she tests everybody else, and she takes me and she puts me back in detox. So now I'm back in detox in the same rehab in a week, right? The weekend staff are coming back like, "Didn't you get out? What are you doing?" I'm like, "Just don't worry about all that. Here I am. Let's do this, you know?" And I'm sitting up there for the second time in the week, sick again a little bit, not as bad. And I'm just like, you know, ask myself, "Kevin, what's it gonna take?" You know? And this is my moment of surrender, because I just realized that nothing was enough. You know what I mean? And that kind of scared me. Like I'd, you know, lost my house, my wife, my kids, and all the things. Like, you know, I've been in trouble and got in trouble again, and nothing was ever gonna be enough, you know? And I was just so desperate. I wanted to pray, you know what I mean? And I'm like, and I don't even know God at this moment, you know? And I said, "If there's anything up there, you know what I mean? If there's anything out there, like, help me, you know, like do something here, right?" And I had this weird little like vision thing happen to me in that moment. It was like a jigsaw puzzle falling from the sky, and it was all these different little events in my life, like all these choices I made that led to the next choice that led to the next choice. And I realized they all came together to lead me up to that very moment, right? And again, like, I'm not a religious person. I've been denying God for so long at that point. Like, I don't want the responsibility of God, you know? My saying at that point is, if there's a God, he hates me. And I believe that. And but something happened to me in that moment, you know, and like any good addict, when I get some relief and something feels good, I want more of it. So I'm like, okay, how do I pray? And I didn't know how to pray. But I had been to a couple of Narcotics Anonymous meetings. So the only prayers that came to my mind were the third step prayer and the serenity prayer, the prayers that you guys told me at the beginning and the end of your meetings, right? Those are the only prayers I could get out. And so I said those prayers. And I remembered some of those meetings. I remembered some of those things I heard in the meetings. And when I got out of that detox for the second time and hit the floor, like I was about all about NA. Like here I am with 3 days clean, trying to help the other people in the rehab and telling them about NA. I'm like all in, you know. It's funny to look at now and laugh about, but I didn't realize what was happening is that I learned later by being of service in this program that I was thinking about someone other than myself for the first time, you know. I was being a service, even though I didn't know what that looked like or what it meant, you know. And something about that felt right, felt good, you know. And I think I was, this is again December 2013. I was still taking some Suboxone that I'd snuck in there. I still wasn't being completely honest, and I felt bad about that. And I wanted to stop doing it. And it was the day before Christmas, and my kids were going to come the next day. And I didn't want them to come. And I was talking to my buddy about it. And he's like, "Well, why don't you want them to come?" And I said, like, "I'm embarrassed, you know, like, you know, my ex has got to bring them up here. And it's just, you know, doing all this crap again." And he said something that stuck with me that I try and remember because it was true then and it's still true today. He said, "Why are you embarrassed? You're doing the best possible thing you could be doing for your life right now." You know, and that was being engaged in being clean and doing something better. And that's still true today. And I'm grateful that I can remember that. I'm grateful for the desperation that led up to those moments to find a little bit of willingness, you know. And so I quit taking the Suboxone and I saw my kids the next day. And that's why my clean date is 12/25/2013, Christmas Day. They say self-centeredness is the core of this disease. And at the time I like thought that was my gift to the world, right? There you go, I got clean. and I didn't know what a gift it was gonna be to me, you know? A week or two later, some other stuff happened and I got kicked out of that program. And I was scared to death. I had a phone snuck in. I still wasn't following the rules, and there was some other stuff happening that had nothing to do with me in the house, and they found the phone, and after everything else, they're like, "You gotta go." And so I'm on the streets with a couple weeks clean, and I don't know what the hell to do. And I go back into parole, and I asked them for help, and they ended up sending me here to Chico. They were not happy with me, but they gave me another chance. And you know, it's one of those things that I didn't know was a gift then. It sure as hell didn't feel like a gift, you know, just like getting arrested didn't feel like a gift, but it was, because when I got here, I got the opportunity to do something that I had never done before, and that was to work an honest program and to try my best. And I was so scared, you know. I'm fighting that prison sentence still. I'm going to court on that. I got this new case and I really want to be clean and it feels good to be clean. And so when I got to this new place, like I did everything I was supposed to do, you know. I did the work and I followed the rules and it was co-ed and I didn't mess around with any of that. And I remember at the end of that thing, like turning to my counselor. And I'm like, "Man, I did that." And he just kind of laughed. He's like, "Yeah, you did that." Like, I don't think he didn't understand the gravity or the importance of that to me. But the importance of it to me was like, "Oh my God, I tried my best at something, and I can look another person in the eyes and say that I tried my best and feel good about my effort, you know?" And I had never done that. It was always about taking the shortcut or getting special treatment or breaking the rules. You know what I mean? I'd never done anything where I just like followed the rules and tried my best at something and it felt good, you know? And really, like, that's another, just one of those things I try and do today still, you know, in work, in relationships, in anywhere I show up. If I try my best and I'm honest and do all the things that I'm supposed to do, like, I know that I can feel good about my effort no matter what the outcome is, you know? So I did that. And I got out here in Chico. Francis used to come get us and take us to meetings. You know, we talked about that a little bit at the podcast. I called him so much every day to come get us to a meeting. At some point, he told me to quit calling him, and he'd let me know if he was going to a meeting. And he did. And he took me to the meetings. And by the time I got out of that rehab, I had a job lined up, and I was plugged into NA and going to NA and living with an NA member. And I still had that court case. And at about 9 months clean, I got sentenced. And you know, I'm doing good at this point. And everyone's like, Kevin, you're not gonna go. You're not gonna go. We see miracles here all the time. And I kind of knew in my heart that I was probably gonna go to prison, right? And that this was just part of the deal. You know what I mean? Like cleaning up my wreckage, like meant that I had to go do the time for the crime a little bit. And what a lesson that was, you know, just it was almost a forced surrender, you know, like I couldn't do anything about it, except for practice some acceptance and surrender and stay in the moment and just realize that, like, man, like, you know, I can stay clean through this, you know, because my MO would have been to run and not deal with it. And again, it's just one of those things where, like, I did what I was supposed to do and I tried my best and I could hold my head, you know, walk in those courtrooms with dignity because I was showing up, you know. And September 2014, you know, at about 9 months clean, I got sentenced to 4 years at 85%. And it was a little devastating, you know. 1 week I'm going to meetings and going to my job, and a week later, like, I'm sitting down in reception in the CDC again, you know, in Tracy. And I'm in there for about 2 months. And you know, you're not getting out, you're not going to meetings, you're lucky to go to yard, let alone to a meeting and to a shower. And you know, Francis would send me some literature, you know, and I remember sharing with him. I get emotional thinking about this because it was important to me. I know it's important to him. I remember feeling so alone in there, you know, other than the letters I got from the other members, that the stories in the back were my fellowship. And I would save them. You know what I mean? I'd try not to read them too quick, like only one a day, you know? And read us because, you know, you're sitting in that cell for, you know, 23 hours a day. It's pretty easy to read a lot of stuff quick, and so I would save them and just read one a day. And so I had them. And thank you, Francis, for sending me the literature. And so I told him that I told him about the stories. And next thing you know, he's photocopying me stories from the other versions. And I don't know where he's finding them all, but I'm getting these packets, you know, of photocopied stories in the mail. And the guys thought it was weird, and I just didn't care, you know. And I knew I could make it through that, even though it was hard. And then, you know, people were talking about we see miracles happen all the time. And not to get too into the political aspects of the laws, but there was a law that went through in California at the time that started, it was part of their prison reduction system program. And they were reducing some of the drug-related felonies to misdemeanors. And you hear all these rumors when you're in prison of how all the stuff that's going to happen by all these jailhouse lawyers who think they know what they're talking about, right? And most of it's not true. And so, you know, I write my appeal attorney and get the paperwork on this thing, and I'm like, oh my God, it's real. Like, I qualify for this. And I wrote him, and he contacted whoever my public defender was back in my home county. And I was the first guy in my county and the second guy in the state brought back out on this proposition that went through that year. And I ended up, instead of doing 3.5, 4 years, I ended up doing 6 months. And they brought me back to county for the last 3 months, and I got out and was able to just plug back into the program, you know.
Yeah,
It
so
seemed like,
before we
yeah.
get into the what you've done once you were able to acclimate into NA again after your prison sentence, there's a couple of things I want to ask you about. The first thing that kind of stood out was you talked about being part of the music scene back in the day, right? Now you talked about the culture, and what I want to touch on is like that can be a very positive scene for a lot of people, but there's a lot of us out there who really enjoy music and we're a part of that scene, but it's really can be detrimental to an addict versus a normal person. Will you just touch on that for a second? Like, not that we're trying to knock the music scene at all, but why is that dangerous for an addict?
I think for several reasons. A, we all know what a song can do to bring back feelings, right? There's that emotional recall with music. And you know, a lot of the drug life is bad, but there's some fun out there, you know what I mean? And we're good, real good as addicts at remembering the fun parts and ignoring the bad parts, you know? And so music maybe reminds us of some of the fun parts and brings back those feelings. There was a period of time where I couldn't really do the whole jam band music scene or even really like separated myself from the music because it was too much for me, you know? And there came a point where we have a friend, a fellow member up here who works security, who is manager for an event security company and hires a bunch of addicts to go to these music events and help do the security. And I was doing that one summer and ended up there's I don't want to promote an outside fellowship, but there's, you know,
Sure.
there's people who are in recovery who go to these things and set up booths, and I was able to I ended up walking around on one of my when I was off, and literally the last house in the block, the last booth I came to, they were having a meeting right then, you know, and I was able to sit in there, and it made a new connection for me of it, like, okay, I can have fun clean and I can dance and hear music and love music, and recovery can be a part of that, you know what I mean? They don't have to be mutually exclusive things, you know, which it was for a while for me.
Yeah,
But
that's kind of what I was leading you to is to talk about that because that's been a gift that recovery's given to me. I can't even count how many shows that I've been to since I've been clean. I was actually at one last night, didn't get home till way early in the morning. But yeah, it's not that we want to knock it, but that other side of the fence can be so dangerous. For an addict, even though a lot of it is about love and connection and those different things, it's just we happen to be exposed to something that we're allergic to, which is, these chemicals that people like to enjoy themselves at those shows with, man. And thank God that there is another side, a group of us that's out there that, we can still in, addiction doesn't get to take that away from us. So that's a beautiful thing. Second thing I want to ask you about is you talked about early on in your life, you started facing some consequences pretty early on, and I think even before you went to high school, is that what you said?
yes, sir. You know, some of it was police involved, some of it was, you know, parents, some of it was school. You know, I got started getting trouble at school at an early age and was kicked out of my junior high, and probably had some police interactions around that time too.
Yeah. My question to follow up with that is, so when from hearing your story, consequences have been a part of your life, your life up until you got into recovery, and even while you were at detox a couple of times, you faced consequences. When did it start to set in that this may be related to this drug use rather than just, a victim of circumstance?
I tell you, it was that moment, sitting out. So many things came to me in that moment, sitting in that detox for the second time, that realization that it just nothing was ever going to be enough, you know? And really what that was, besides the surrender, was I didn't have the language for it, but that admission that I couldn't manage this any longer. Basically, any illusion that I'd still been perpetuating with myself that I could somehow control my usage in one way or another was shattered, you know? Because I always, like I said, I was real good at jumping through those hoops and fixing yesterday's problems, you know? I could manipulate or stay clean long enough to get through probation or parole, you know what I mean? And to get a job and to get the lights back on and to get the old lady home again and to pay rent one more month. But eventually that stuff would just, you know, it would cycle back out. But it was always this game of like trying to fix everything, but still manage that, you know, and that illusion just got shattered in that moment, you know? And what a gift that is though, to have to not have to fight that battle anymore, you know? It's exhausting to think about.
While you were telling your story and getting up to where you got to, what stuck out is you talked about that importance of practicing honesty, finally getting completely honest with yourself. And it looked like for, or it sounded like for some periods of time you would practice some honesty, but just wouldn't completely get honest, completely surrender, like you said. Your miracle that you needed was on the other side of that surrender and that honesty. It's a beautiful thing, man.
Yes, sir. Grateful.
So before we get into NA, I want to talk about you talked about Francis sending you some stuff in prison. Outside of those stories, were there people in there that you got exposed to that you could talk to about your recovery at all, that was interested in doing anything different? Was you able to lean on anybody in there, or did it all come from outside of the gates?
No, it all came from the outside of the gates. I actually, so when I first got to the reception, I ended up seeing this guy in there who had come to the fellowship in Chico for a minute, right? I'd seen him in the rooms here, and then he drifted back out. I think he had some warrants in another county and ended up obviously there. And he was like, "Oh, Kev, you know, like he wanted." He begged me for a while, and I didn't want to do it to move in with him, you know what I mean? So he could have somebody else in recovery and you know, kind of have that support system, because he was trying to stay clean. And I finally did it and accepted a room move, and I get down there and, you know, he's getting loaded and buying pills off the tier and begging the neighbor for whatever leftovers he had. And it was, you know, it was pretty sad. It was a desperate situation, you know?
That makes me think that there's something about recovery. Maybe it's not what all you're exposed to. It's your ability to put your best effort. You didn't have access to people you could talk to. All your recovery was coming from outside of the gate, but you were giving it an effort and you got a result, even though you didn't get to get exposed to meetings and a fellowship of people inside of there that was trying to be clean. I think that a lot can be said about that. Just like sometimes recovery just takes our best effort, not necessarily even when we're limited on our resources. It's awesome, man.
I think that, you know, I try and look at the gift in situations that don't feel like gifts at the time, because, you know, I have many. And, you know, the gift there was I got to have an active relationship with the literature, you know. I got to get in that basic text, and it meant that much more to me, because it's all I had, you know.
I think for me, when you had expressed your interest in the stories, and I sent you more stories, it like I was already interested in the stories, and I was trying to figure out who they were, but it even furthered my obsession with the stories. Like, oh, I know where there's even more stories in the sixth edition. There's like stories in the fifth edition, and there's stories in the little white book, and but like it. And it like it made it I like I made it my business to figure those fucking stories out. Who are these people? Like it you know, like your interest furthered my interest. And I've gone off the deep end with that. You know, like you know that.
That's become a gift to us all.
Right.
What a blessing to run into the one guy. If you really love the stories and you need more stories, I mean, you ran into the best guy in the country for that. That's unbelievable.
He's responsible for being the best guy for that.
That's awesome.
I also wanted to acknowledge the music thing. Because for a long time, like when Jerry died, you know, like I cried and I got clean afterwards. I thought I'd never get to experience like any type of dead stuff again. And it was kind of like our little crew in Chico, like our little wharf rat crew in Chico, gave me permission to go back. And our friend Amy just said, you should just come. You know, like there was a Jerry Garcia band, you know, like playing at the big room in Chico. And she kind of gave me permission. And after that, it was kind of on. I like to go see the jam bands and anything that's kind of like dead affiliated. And they're like our little group of people gave me permission to go back to the music because I never thought I'd get to do that again. And you're one of those people.
It's awesome. It's one of the best gifts of recovery, man, I've had some of the most fun that I've had since I've been clean with a group of addicts going out and seeing music. It's unreal. You know, it's nothing like it. I didn't think that it could top the prior experiences. You know, I thought the only way you could really enjoy those shows was under the influence. And I had no idea that the best way to experience them is with people that are clean. I mean, for me, that's my personal experience, that I have enjoyed them so much more since I've gotten clean and being around people who are clean, and it's unreal. The music hits different for me, you know, and you're stuck feeling those emotions and things that the music brings on. And, you know, there's kind of a reality that sets in that this is what living is. It's not trying to change these feelings that I'm feeling. It's experiencing them in the moment. It's something very beautiful about it.
Nice to remember what was played last night too. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's great.
All right, Kevin. So to kind of transition a little bit, I'm really interested, you know, you've kind of set the stage for us. So I'm really interested to, you know, the miracle, like what does life look like since you found NA? What did you get involved with in NA? And, you know, bring us up to present day.
You know, I remember my first meeting back. We were at the old hall over there on Cherry Street, and it was a speaker jam that day. And I got in there and I couldn't stop crying, man. Like, I just felt so vulnerable, and I realized that all those walls that I had worked so hard to tear down, just like in that 6 months, were just right back up, but they were crumbly at best, you know. And I ended up having to walk out of that meeting, and you know, my buddy Brian, who I'm sure Francis has talked about too, he's one that, you know, I've learned a lot from Francis through Brian, you know what I mean? Because Francis has got X amount of years and Brian's got, you know, twice as much as I have. And, you know, it's that ripple effect we get to have, you know? And so I was experiencing some of Francis, not even from Francis, you know? He came out to see how I was doing, what was wrong. And I just told him, like, I couldn't deal. And he asked me what I needed. And I said, trees, big trees. And he loaded me up in his car and took me to the coast. And I barely knew that dude, man. And you know, now he's easily my best friend, you know. And it's just one of those relationships in Narcotics Anonymous that I'm so thankful for, you know. I got right back to I think I worked for a while when I first got out, but then I started going to school. I'd always wanted to go to school, but I was unteachable. You know what I mean? I couldn't admit that I didn't know everything, you know? And I was scared to death when I went back to school, and I got in there and I figured out that I was a good student, you know? When you actually have a little bit of an open mind and practice the things that you guys taught me, you know, I did what you guys told me to do in the meetings. I sat in the front and I asked questions if I didn't understand, and I listened the whole time in class. And you know, lo and behold, I ended up being a pretty darn good student. And I got through that and started working, and I've been at the same job for, you know, since that time, and that's kind of new stuff too. And really, like, all the physical stuff, getting off parole is great, right? That's probably my highest goal when I first got clean was to not go to jail anymore, not going to prison to get off parole. But all the physical stuff is cool, but really, like, the value in my life is the relationships, and then the esteem gained through being of services program, you know. When I got here, you guys told me to go to meetings, get a sponsor, work the steps, and be a service. And those are the things I just still try and do. Like, I've always had a service position, and that's changed in multiple times. And I am someone who did not want to sponsor people for a long time, and I started sponsoring, you know, several years back now. And I tell you, there's like, you know, there's no greater gift to me than when my guys come over and work the steps, man. I can't imagine of a just, you know, I hope they get as much out of it as I get out of it. You know, it gets me right in the head. It gets me out of myself. It gets me going through the step working guide and the literature again. And I get to just be part of this process. And I guess that there's so many gifts this program has given me, but I think it's probably the biggest one is to being part of the process, you know what I mean? To be an instrument of the higher power that I didn't believe in for so long, to get to witness like him working in other people's lives and to be a part of that's freaking amazing to me. Like, yeah, it's cool to not put drugs in my butt and not be on probation and not go to prison and all that stuff. It's cool to have a job and to have a car and all that's great, but you know. I remember, like, there's that piece in our basic text where it talks about if you made a list of things you wanted when you first got clean, you'd be cheating yourself, right? And I literally, sitting in rehab, was like, I just want to be normal. I just want to have a house and a wife and a car and kids. And I had all that stuff. It wasn't enough, you know? And the stuff I have today, even though it's not those things, it's greater than that. I have relationships with people like Francis and Brian and a handful other of my litter mates that got clean around the same time that are, you know, my little circle of besties that like are not based off of how we can perpetuate each other's addictions, you know? People aren't calling me because I have the drugs or because they're trying to sell me drugs, you know? People are calling me to talk about their stuff, you know, and it blows me away sometimes still. Like here in the last couple of years, I've really kind of had a shift in my identity finally, because even for the longest, you know, what do they say? They say, we don't think our way into a new way of living. We live our way into a new way of thinking. And that's meant something new to me recently. Like I've started to accept that I'm an okay guy, you know what I mean? And it took a long time of not doing dirtball shit to give up that mentality and that self-identity, you know? And I still struggle with that sometimes, you know, but I'm grateful to do it. And I don't say that because, like, you know, I spent a lot of time living a dirty life trying to convince everyone I was a good dude, you know? And it's a lot funner today to talk dirty and live clean than to live dirty and talk clean, you know. I'm a strong believer in that. I had there was a just for today a couple days ago that talked about measuring our success by comparing ourselves with who we are today to who we used to be, you know? And I had this situation yesterday at work, which is thankfully for me my greatest source of drama, and it's not really, it's pretty good, you know? And I had my boss come to me, and you know, he said he basically was complaining that he thought that I wasn't doing something, and it was something that I was doing. You know, it was answering our some of our international clients, and I had been taking care of it. He just wasn't aware of it. And you know, and just as soon as he starts, like I feel that resistance in me balling up, right? And I'm feel angry and defensive, and I'm building my case to justify my behavior and action. And luckily for me, someone else walked in to talk to us for that for a moment, and I was able to take a breath. And in that moment, like, you know, some of the other stuff in the literature kind of kicked in, like, you know, you don't always have to be right, you know, like I don't have to defend untrue virtues, you know, and I, you know, that self-awareness of gaining this program of looking to where I'm wrong instead of where I'm right first, and being able to see where I am right or wrong, and then asking myself, like, well, yeah, you've done that, he's wrong, but could you do better? Is what I asked myself. And I said, I can do better. And so when that person walked out, I turned to him and I said, I will try and do better, you know? And just like that, like any tension that was in the room was just gone. He was ready for a fight. I was ready to fight him. And it just went away, and it was so much easier. And I tell you that just because that's one of those moments where I can see like recovery working in my life. And I think for me, that's the goal. It's real-time recovery. I talked a lot about fixing yesterday's mistakes, and I don't want to keep fixing yesterday's mistakes. I know when I act out on defects, it causes me pain and it causes other people's pain, you know? And I don't want to have to keep making amends or fixing relationships or finding new jobs. And if I can engage in some real-time recovery, like I'm not making the messes that I used to make, you know, and life's easier and it's a little bit more peaceful and I feel better about myself and I'm more pleasant to be around. And what a gift that is. And I just owe that all to you guys, you know. So if I had to say what, you know, I'm just grateful for Narcotics Anonymous. Like, this is the gift that keeps on giving. I'm working, I just started, I'm starting a 12 step right now. I just finished an 11 step. And I had one of those moments with my 11 step where I hate some of the cliches that we hear around here, and I try and avoid them at all costs. And one of my least favorite is you're right where you're supposed to be. And I had this moment about a month or two ago where I was trying to take care of like my insurance and that kind of stuff, and I was having some problems with that, and it's like some medical stuff that I was trying to deal with. And I spent 4 hours on the phone trying to, you know, do my part, do the footwork right, and didn't get the results I wanted. You know, I came up with a plan for next year, but didn't get the results I wanted, and was like, okay, I got to walk away, and I go do some errands. And I'm not on the road very long before I realize there's a lot of motherfuckers driving on the road today, right? And I think like a pretty good gauge of if you want to gauge my spiritual condition, just get in the car with me for a few minutes, you know? And my spiritual condition was not good. And that happens, you know, like I get mad, like there's some idiot drivers here in our town. And but usually like, you know, something happens and I let it go. And I'm getting madder and madder and madder, and I catch myself, you know. People say feelings aren't facts. Well, I have another friend who says feelings aren't facts, but they are indicators. And so me not being in peace in that moment, having that mad was an indicator. And so I stopped and took a breath, you know, and did a little prayer. And what I realize is, you know, being on that 11 step, being right where I'm supposed to be, is that sometimes I go through the motions in recovery, and sometimes I'm engaged. And I knew that I was saying prayers every day and doing my meditation, but I wasn't really engaged in it. And so I got the chance to reset here about 2 months ago, and be present in those moments when I pray and when I meditate, not just go through the motions. And it's just been one of those, you know, we have those moments. They're not always like this, at least not for me, but I have those moments where like, oh yeah, I get to start to see those reflections of the higher power working in my life with other people and with myself. And so, you know, here I am at coming up on 11 years clean and just feeling a little bit refreshed in this program. And you know, they say you get out of it what you put into it, and I've always gotten so much more out of it than I've ever been willing to put into it, you know. And that's really my truth is I don't know if I ever work this program to the best of my ability. I work it to the best of my willingness, which is different at different moments. And I'm just thankful to have some willingness that isn't born of desperation, you know. There's that piece in the Living Clean that talks about there's a point in our recovery when we stop moving away from pain and start moving towards freedom, I think it is, or something, you know. And I don't know when that happened for me, but I owe that to you guys. You can jump in here anytime, Mason.
Awesome. No,
I'm
no,
tired of
that
my
was,
voice.
no, that was great. First thing that I thought is I need to get the t-shirt guy over here to make a t-shirt, talk dirty and live clean. I love that. Yeah, and I love the that feelings aren't facts, but feelings are indicators. I really enjoyed that. Francis, I'm gonna let you take over now. This is your part.
Burning desire. You have a grand finale, like fireworks and shit. You have something you want to part with that you want to tie it all off with?
Man, I don't know that I have anymore, but you know, I'm always just willing to tell anybody who's out there listening, who thinks they can't get through some situation that like, you know, I got through going back to prison clean and stayed clean, and that was tough, you know. And I've seen people stay clean through losing their kids, and my ex-roommate, she got her kids back, and I think that was harder than losing them. I told her she gets to stay clean through that now, you know. So if you're out there struggling with anything, there's someone in here who has stayed clean through that, you know, and you can too. And you know, I just want everyone to find the freedom that I've gotten out of this program and tell them that they're worth it and to keep coming back and to just take the damn suggestions. You don't have to understand them, you know, just do them and you know, live your way into a new way of thinking.
Yeah,
Perfect.
I want to just first of all thank you, Kevin, for coming and sharing your story. It just really warms my heart to know that the guy who leaned on the personal stories has a personal story that's fixing to enter the stratosphere and help somebody else. It's a beautiful thought to think about that, and thank you for allowing us to experience that with you.
Thank you.
Like I know some of the storytellers listen to this podcast, so I'm sure they'll be hearing you.
There you go. And if you're going to be on the work committee for the seventh edition, keep this one in mind. No, that was great, y'all. Thank you. We will be back. We're going to come back with our Living Clean study. We'll have more history for you and more personal stories. So, we have a bright future ahead and looking forward to sharing all that with y'all. We'll be back next week. See you then.
Thank you for joining us on our Living Clean podcast. This is another platform that we can share our message of recovery, which is an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Join that no matter what club. You can contact us through text. The number is 931-306-9364.